Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brennst du für Technologien, die unsere Zukunft verändern? Dann code, plane, pilotiere, entwickle, erfinde, beschleunige und digitalisiere. Industrien, Städte, Mobilität, kurzum, alles, was unser Leben bewegt. Du willst aktiv das Morgen mitgestalten? Dann komm jetzt in unser Team. Geh einfach auf unser Jobportal siemens.de/karriere. Create a better tomorrow with us.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On this edition, more trade tariffs have been threatened against China today by the US as concern builds over alleged Chinese dumping of goods onto the global market. How much can Mexico benefit, perhaps, from this trans-Pacific tension as more countries in the region try to woo business?
The question is, how much of that trend we can take advantage of, because I am sure that some people are having the same discussion in Colombia, in Vietnam, in Costa Rica.
Also in World Business Report today, Adidas, the sportswear giant, talks about life after Kanye West. And Denmark mourns the destruction by fire of its historic stock exchange building. All of that to come later. But first, as the US presidential election campaign starts to intensify, there are worrying reports for Donald Trump's campaign, it seems, of what may be an impending cash shortfall. The Financial Times has calculated that he's raised some $75 million less for his presidential bid this year than Joe Biden. At least that's over recent months. He has 270,000 fewer unique donors than he had at the same stage of his White House bid 4 years ago. Let's bring in Larry Sabato here. He is the director at the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. He's a veteran poll watcher in the US. Professor Sabato, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show. First of all, $75 million. It sounds like a lot of money to be missing versus your rival. Is it, in political terms?
No, it is not. Now, it's important to note, it's always better to have more money than less. And right now, Joe Biden has more money, and he may have more money all the way through to November. But here's the problem for Biden. His opponent is not unknown, as most challengers to incumbents have been in American history. Donald Trump, if anything, is better known than the incumbent president, Joe Biden. So people already think they know these two candidates, or they think they know enough about them to make a decision. And in fact, the vast majority of voters already have made their decision. So it's not a good thing that Trump is not raising more money. He's going to have the problem of multiple trials. He has hired so many lawyers and legal assistants, they could form a very big law firm. They have to be paid for, and some of this money will be diverted to the lawyers.
Yeah.
But for Trump, it's not really crippling.
Just describe very simply for us what money goes towards typically in a campaign that would ever kind of shift the dial, so to speak.
The greatest amount goes to television advertising and associated media expenses, streaming and the like, internet ads. Some of them can be quite expensive, certainly on major networks. So that's the number one expense. Often we have had 80% of all the money raised diverted to advertising of one sort or another. Second would be organizing the campaign and paying salaries and the rest of it. But for Trump, where this is hurting right now is that Biden is organizing satellite offices all over the place. When I say all over the place, I mean, of course, in the 7 or 8 states that are actually competitive. We could call 40 to 42 of the states right now sitting here for November. But for the 7 or 8 states that will actually decide the election, Biden is spending a lot of money getting organizers and get out the vote specialists, local door-to-door people. And Trump really can't do that. In fact, they can't even point in some big states like Pennsylvania to specific local headquarters.
Okay, that's interesting. We're going to come back to you in a moment, Professor Zapata, but let's just bring in Joe Seamus now. He's also in Virginia. He's a founder of Flintlock Capital. He's a Republican and a member of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Small Business Council. Hi, Joe. Thanks for joining us. Are you currently donating or fundraising for the Trump campaign?
I've fundraised in the past for various Republican candidates.
Right. And there is a lot of talk here, isn't there, about how much this shortfall might be hurting Donald Trump in a large state like Virginia? I mean, do you think it will affect the machine that will be out there fighting for him when the campaign really intensifies?
Well, I largely agree with what was previously said. I think that campaign fundraising is only one metric. It's important, but it's not the leading thing that's going to count today, I think. I think most people already have their minds made up. I think it's very easy to feel how policy decisions today affect you. You don't need someone else to tell you that. You can see it through your friends and family. You can see it through your business. If you believe in American innovation, for example, you can see how centrally planned and managed energy infrastructure impacts you and your fuel prices compared to one that's driven by free enterprise. So people, I think, have a very strong feeling about how these candidates impact their lives directly. And so I think fundraising is only one component of that. And while it's important, I don't think it's the only thing.
Does it make a difference if the Republican candidate's legal costs seem to be so much of the, you know, the commercial focus right now, particularly when it comes to, you know, donated money? A lot of it is apparently being channeled into his legal battles.
Well, as was said, everyone knows who President Trump is. And so in its own odd way, it seems that the more legal challenges there are, the more popularity he gets. And so I can't perfectly articulate why that is. But it's a phenomena that we're witnessing, and it continues to gain interest. So that's media he doesn't have to pay for, whether it's positive or negative.
Yeah. Could he benefit from the underdog tag, do you think?
I think he is. And I think there are a whole lot of people that are being drawn to his candidacy today because they're seeing how different parts of the government are being used against a political candidate. And that's not something that most of us have ever witnessed in our lives. And so that certainly is attracting a whole lot of new people to his campaign.
Professors, thank you very much for that, Joe Seamus in Virginia. I mean, Professor Zapata, a final thought. You were obviously downplaying the significance of the money, but if it comes to it, as you say, in those swing states where a big investment may be required at the last minute when it's down to the last 1 or 2% and you need to get out the vote, it doesn't perhaps take shifting the dial very much, just a few thousand one way or the other, that can make the difference. And perhaps money could play a part there.
That's a very good point. If this is as close as many people think it will be in the end, and I'm not yet fully convinced of that, but if it is very close, then certainly a few thousand votes can do it. Joe Biden won the popular vote in 2020 by well over 7 million votes. Yet the election actually came down to 43,000 votes in four of the key swing states. 43,000. Had they gone to Trump instead of Biden, Trump, even though he lost the popular vote overwhelmingly, would have had another four-year term as president.
Professor Larry Zapata at the University of Virginia, thank you. And my thanks also there to Joe Seamus, also in Virginia, founder of Flintlock Capital. Now, for some of the other stories affecting the markets today, I'm joined by Russ Mould, the investment director at AJ Bell. Hi, Russ.
Hello, Ed.
First of all, let's discuss inflation. When do we not discuss inflation, Russ? The Fed chair has been talking again about this today, and we've had some UK inflation numbers.
Yes, yeah, so start with the Federal Reserve head chair, Jay Powell. He's speaking at the International Monetary Fund semi-annual meeting in Washington, D.C. in America. And he seems to be backing away from his previous stance. Since last autumn, he's been talking about how American interest rates had peaked, how that cuts would be coming in 2024, and financial markets have gone off at a big gallop as a result of that, with the S&P 500 stock market index up by a quarter since then. But he's now admitting that inflation's coming in a bit stickier than expected and maybe higher for longer, and as a result that the Federal Reserve may not move as quickly as it was originally intending. Financial markets began this year looking for 6 rate cuts. Now they're looking for just 2 from the Fed. And it's the same picture in the UK for the same reason. Sticky inflation. The first cut is now expected in August, a second in December. So again, just 2 from the UK. And that's because inflation in the UK is cooling, as it is in America, but nowhere near as quickly as anticipated, with services staying sticky, goods prices finally starting to decelerate quite nicely.
And when the Fed holds interest rates, that kind of exports high interest rates to other countries, or at least it forces other countries to think twice about making cuts themselves.
It's definitely a consideration. I mean, Mr. Andrew Bailey, the governor of the Bank of England, is talking about the Bank of England maybe moving first, but he might not want to get too far ahead, because then if you can park your money in dollars and get a bigger return than relative to pounds, or an even bigger than return you're getting previously than keeping it in pounds, money will flow into dollars. The pound will go down, and that means that your imports are potentially more expensive, and that means, yes, more inflation.
OK, Russ, stay with us, because we're going to need to hear a little bit more from you in a second. But this is something that I think is relevant to some of our conversations today. In recent years, Mexico has generated significant expectation and positivity about its economic outlook, partly because of a major uptick in what's being called nearshoring. This is where US companies based in China have relocated to Mexico, a nearer shore to the US, if you like. But it's not just US firms getting in on the act here. Chinese companies have also been taking advantage of conditions in northern Mexico to cut down on shipping costs and, crucially, to get around US sanctions on Chinese goods by making them in Mexico instead. Our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant, now reports from the northern city of Monterrey.
The reclining armchairs and plush leather sofas coming off the production line at the Manhua Furniture Company are 100% made in Mexico. They're destined for large department stores in the United States, like Costco, Walmart, and in time, IKEA. But the company is from China. It's a Mexican factory built with Chinese capital. It's a triangular relationship behind the buzzword in Mexican business, nearshoring. Manhua is one of scores of Chinese companies to relocate to industrial parks in northern Mexico in recent years to bring production closer to the US market. As well as saving on shipping, their final product is considered completely Mexican, meaning firms can avoid tariffs and sanctions imposed on Chinese goods amid the worsening trade war with the US. As general manager Yu Ken-hui shows me around the vast 330,000 square meter lot, he says the move to Mexico has made economic and logistical sense. The company already employs 450 people and, he adds, has some ambitious plans. We hope to triple or even quadruple production, he says in perfect Spanish. The intention here in Mexico is to bring production up to the level of our operation in Vietnam. But it's not just Mexico's strategic position next to the US which has made it attractive, Yu Ken-hui explains.
People here in Mexico are very hardworking and fast learners. On the labour side, it's gone very well for us. We've got good operators. Generally, people stay with us and their productivity is high. So I think in this area, Mexico is strategically very good too.
The hubbub of this Chinese-owned and run furniture factory is pretty impressive considering it first moved to Monterrey in 2022. But whether it's furniture, textiles or car parts, the truth is the proximity to the United States and the skilled labour force here makes Mexico an increasingly obvious choice to locate a factory. And more Chinese companies are making that same calculation to set up their operations here.
The sofa factory is located inside Hofusan, a Chinese-Mexican industrial park in the city of Monterrey. Demand for plots is sky high. Every available space is sold. In fact, the Industrial Parks Association of Mexico says every plot due to be constructed in the country by 2027 has already been bought up. Little wonder many economists say China's interest in Mexico is no passing fad.
I understand that the origin of the capital might be uncomfortable for some countries, But the fact is that according to international trade legislation, those products and those companies are, for all intents and purposes, Mexican.
Juan Carlos Baker Pineda is Mexico's former vice minister for external trade and was part of the Mexican negotiating team on the new North American Free Trade Agreement, USMCA.
In my mind, actually, the question is not if this trend will continue, but rather how much of that trend we can take advantage of, because I am sure that some people are having the same discussion in Colombia, in Vietnam, in Costa Rica. So we need to make sure in Mexico that those conditions that are aligned by themselves go hand in hand with the corporate and government decisions that we take in this country to sustain that trend in the long term.
Probably the most significant announcement of the day is that we're excited to announce that we're going to be building a gigafactory in Mexico.
There's a second key part of nearshoring, U.S. firms setting up in northern Mexico too, either as direct new investment or relocating from Asia. An announcement by Elon Musk last year of a new Tesla gigafactory to be built outside Monterrey is perhaps the standout investment promise of the nearshoring trend.
So, super excited about it.
In the process, Mexico has replaced China as the US's main trading partner. It's a significant and symbolic change, but some urge caution over being drawn into the wider geopolitical struggle. Enrique Dussel is head of the Center for China-Mexico Studies at the National Autonomous University in Mexico.
What we're witnessing since 2017 is this profound clash and confrontation between China and the United States. The old rich guy in town, the United States, is having problems with the new rich guy in town, China, no? And Mexico does not have a strategy vis-a-vis China and how to deal into this new triangular relationship.
The talented Mexican seamstresses at Manoir Furniture put the finishing touches to another sofa before it's shipped north. When an American family buys it later at a Walmart or IKEA store near them, they may have little idea of the complex geopolitics which underpins its production. But whether a backdoor into the US or part of a costly war between superpowers, nearshoring is here to stay. For Mexico, the challenge lies in reaping long-term benefits of this new alignment in global commerce while maintaining strong ties with both of its most important trading partners.
Will Grant reporting there from Monterrey in Mexico. You're with World Business Report from the BBC.
Brennst du für Technologien, die unsere Zukunft verändern? Dann code, plane, pilotiere, entwickle, erfinde, beschleunige und digitalisiere. Industrien, Städte, Mobilität, kurzum, alles, was unser Leben bewegt. Du willst aktiv das Morgen mitgestalten? Dann komm jetzt in unser Team. Geh einfach auf unser Jobportal siemens.de/karriere. Create a better tomorrow with us.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
World Service. Well, Russ Mould is still with us. Russ, all of this talk we've just been hearing there of US tariffs on China, it's topical, isn't it, today? Because once again, we've been hearing from President Biden talking of further big hikes on tariffs on Chinese steel.
Correct. And this is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So we may be talking politics as much as economics here. Pennsylvania's got 19 seats in the Electoral College out of the 538 that the presidential candidates are fighting for. And President Biden won Pennsylvania by a very small margin 4 years ago. He's talking about extra tariffs on Chinese steel, increasing the ones that President Trump put on. So again, you can see the politics of it, preserving American jobs, onshoring. But at the same time, it could perhaps potentially increase the cost of that domestic steel because American workers cost more. So there's a choice there of jobs versus inflation, but it's It's part of this big ongoing debate over tariffs, trade, technology and security.
But it's also about alleged Chinese dumping, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
There was more evidence, I think, today. The Financial Times again published certain data. It was talking about how Chinese statistics were showing something like 10% hike in investment in manufactured goods, many of which are exports. There is obviously very weak demand in China, so stuff is coming out of China at very discounted prices. And it's not just America, it's Europe that's very worried about that.
No, indeed. But again, the debate then is, are you happy to accept those cheaper prices, or are you happy to make it perhaps domestically but more expensive? So there are considerations on both sides. There is also still a little bit of a nationalistic element to the trade situation. Remember that Nippon Steel of Japan is looking to bid for US steel in a $15 billion deal. And both candidates for the presidency, Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump, have both said that they will look to block that deal if they get the chance.
OK, final quick thought for the Dutch semiconductor supplier firm ASML. It's announced weaker results today. What's behind this?
The shares were up 50% over the last year. It's seen as a big part of the artificial intelligence chain because it makes the machines that make the chips that drive artificial intelligence products from companies like NVIDIA. And although its first quarter numbers were good, they weren't absolutely brilliant, which after a huge run in the shares meant that one or two investors have decided to lock in some profits. And also the order intake was weaker than expected, though the company still saying, don't worry, we'll get a strong second half and all will be well.
Russ Mould, thank you very
thank
much
you.
Indeed. Next, a change in who is top of the charts when it comes to producing oil in Africa. OPEC, the group of oil-producing countries, has said that Libya has now overtaken Nigeria as the top African crude oil producer, at least for the month of March. It's partly due to a rise in Libyan oil production and a slight fall in Nigerian crude production, which OPEC says is down to a surge in pipeline vandalism there in the Nigerian Delta. Abdul Karim Al Ghezwi is a managing director at Titan Libya, which is an oil services company.
Libya recorded the largest oil producer in Africa last March. You know, taking over Nigeria is not easy, but this came after a hard work and a strategic plan by all the companies like Surti, Mellitah, Waha. They increased their production in order to reach this level.
Yeah, I mean, what has happened? Oil production in Libya, which of course has been struggling for many, many years, particularly since the war in 2011, gradually oil production has been going up and up in Libya, right?
Yeah, because there are many sources in order to increase the production. Oil and gas production is under one national oil corporation, and it controls all the productions.
There is a problem, though, more generally, isn't there? And there has been with investment in Libya because of the tension between the two rival governments in Libya. Does that affect the way that foreigners view the oil industry in Libya?
Actually, no longer affects, because international companies are resuming their services in Libya, such as Tatneft has been back to Libya around 2 years ago, Total Energy 2 years ago also. So international companies are reaching out and are approaching the NOC in order to make a new deal of investment. So international playmakers on oil and gas are still available and they look for new investment in Libya.
I mean, of course, Libya has the largest or some of the largest proven reserves, doesn't it, across Africa. It's just not had the investment. How much does it matter being number one in Africa? How much does that change things for Libya and the profile of your country?
Well, oil production to reach this level, many things will be changing the Libyan living situation. As you know, oil production or oil is the first source of Libyan economy. Also, the international companies now will see that the largest oil production in Africa is very close. The position or the location of Libya is crucial to the Europe. Very, very easy shipping. The international companies are available those will change the picture of Libya in the next coming months. I mean, international companies, they see Libya is semi-stable or is going to be stable, and the security situation is improving everywhere. I'm talking to you now while I'm out of Tripoli, around 100 kilometers, and the area is very safe. And now is attracting the international investor.
That's Abdul Karim Al-Ghezwi speaking to me from Tripoli in Libya, currently Africa's top oil-producing nation. German sportswear giant Adidas has shown better than expected performances results during its first quarter. And those forecasts that we're hearing are thanks to, of all things, its Yeezy collection.
I want people to feel like it's okay to make mistakes in front of people and follow what their dreams are. I want people to feel like awesome is possible.
The words there of Ye, formerly the artist formerly known as Kanye West. Previously, the collaboration between Adidas and Ye had been fraught with the rapper and producer's allegedly anti-Semitic comments that he made last year. Those comments proved terminal to the relationship with the German sportswear giant. But now it seems that offloading the company's Yeezy collection of sneakers has actually buoyed Adidas's profits. I've been speaking to Matt Powell. He's a sports industry analyst at the NPD Group.
I think they have done a very good job of managing their way out of this mess. Just tremendous amount of shoes that they had to sell. And they were trying to figure out the most painless way, if you will, of liquidating that inventory. So, you know, this was a very challenging situation for Adidas. There was no really good solution to work their way out of it. They ultimately decided to sell the product through their own website and donate a portion of the funds. That has gone okay for them. They sold another big chunk of inventory this last quarter, and they're almost now out of that product. They will have a challenge as we get into the next few quarters of offsetting those sales, because there's no product that really can replace the Yeezy goods. So their top line will still be somewhat challenged, but their bottom line should look a lot better. And by the time we get around a year, the impact of this will completely be washed out.
But it's easy to forget, isn't it, that Kanye West's Yeezy business, the brand that he created that caused all of this stir when he posted these anti-Semitic comments, that was a huge brand within the sneaker world, wasn't it? And Adidas were in deep with him.
Yes, this was absolutely a major collaboration, a net of Michael Jordan and Nike. There probably has never been a collaboration that was of this magnitude. It was a huge loss for them. But as I say, they're pretty much putting this behind them at this point, and it should be a much clearer picture of how the brand's performing as we go forward.
Yeah, they're not just putting it behind them, though, are they? They've surpassed $357 million in profits, which sounds pretty healthy.
Yes. Well, again, I think they didn't make the same profit they would have if all of this hadn't happened, but it's still a substantial number. And again, it will be difficult to offset this one-time event. I think the brand's on its way to recovery now.
Yes, the thoughts there of Matt Powell, the sports industry analyst at the NPD Group, on the latest results from Adidas. That's all for today's World Business Report.
Brennst du für Technologien, die unsere Zukunft verändern? Dann code, plane, pilotiere, entwickle, erfinde, beschleunige und digitalisiere. Industrien, Städte, Mobilität, kurzum, alles, was unser Leben bewegt. Du willst aktiv das Morgen mitgestalten? Dann komm jetzt in unser Team. Geh einfach auf unser Jobportal siemens.de/karriere. Create a better tomorrow with us.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.